I'm Nathan Sterner, in for Tom Hall, and this is the Midday News Wrap. In a week of tumultuous political developments, the battle over health care loomed large in Washington as members of the Republican-controlled House and Senate sparred over the language and the spirit of a health insurance plan designed to replace the Affordable Care Act. President Trump found himself blocked by federal judges for the second time from implementing his executive order temporarily banning travel from six Muslim-majority countries. And Mr. Trump's first crack at proposing a federal budget offered a stunning insight into his priorities on defense, diplomacy, and domestic programs. We're going to wade into these and other news stories this hour with our panel of experts, including Amy Goldstein, national reporter for The Washington Post, Michael Dresser, state House correspondent for The Baltimore Sun, and Richard Cross, a conservative columnist and blogger. But first, the news. Good afternoon on this St. Patrick's Day Friday. I'm Nathan Sterner, in for Tom Hall, and welcome to the Midday News Wrap. In this seventh week of the Trump administration, Republicans in Congress continued to wrangle over a health care plan to replace the Affordable Care Act. President Trump's second try at an executive order temporarily banning travel from six Muslim-majority countries and halting all refugee admissions was blocked by federal court rulings in Hawaii and Maryland, rulings that the White House says it will appeal. President Trump also unveiled his first proposed federal budget, calling for big increases in defense spending and deep cuts across a wide swath of social programs and federal agencies, including the EPA and the state, labor, and agriculture departments. And here in Maryland, in the General Assembly, amid partisan battles over paid sick leave and bail reform measures, the House of Delegates passed a revised version of Governor Hogan's $43.5 billion state budget proposal, with some revisions. That $43.5 billion budget plan is now moving on to the state Senate. Helping us to sort out the week's developments are Amy Goldstein, national reporter for The Washington Post with a focus on health care policy. She joins us on the line from the Post newsroom in Washington, D.C. Amy Goldstein, welcome.
Good to be with you.
With me on the line from Annapolis is Michael Dresser, state House correspondent for the Baltimore Sun. Michael, good to have you here.
Good afternoon.
And here in studio is Richard Cross, former press secretary and speechwriter for Maryland Governor Robert Ehrlich, and now a conservative columnist and blogger at rjc-crosspurposes on blogspot.com. Richard, welcome.
Good to be here.
So I want to start with health care. It seems like so long ago, but it was just Monday that the Congressional Budget Office issued its scoring of the American Health Care Act, the Republicans' plan to replace the Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. It says that some 24 million fewer people would have coverage a decade from now than if the ACA remains intact. Amy Goldstein, break down what else we learned from the CBO report.
Well, this report was very important, and it was a little bit coming after the House Republicans had released their plans. They released their plans a week ago Monday without the congressional budget analysts having had time yet to figure out two important things: what it would do to the federal budget and what it would do to the number of people in Americans with health insurance. So by the time this report came out this past Monday, there was a lot of pent-up eagerness to figure out what it was going to say. And for the Republicans, it had good news and bad news in terms of what the Republicans' goals are with these revisions they're trying to push through to federal health care policy. The good news for the GOP in the House was that the plan showed that over 10 years, this legislation would have an effect of lowering the federal deficit by $337 billion. So to the extent that the Republicans want to lower federal spending, that finding actually was useful to them. On the other hand, the CBO report stirred up a bit of a ruckus by showing what would happen to the insured population of this country. It would start out with a $14 million reduction in the number of people with coverage next year. And as you say, by the end of a decade, it would essentially more than reverse the gains in coverage that the Affordable Care Act has made in the last few years.
You noted that the plan would lower the deficit by $337 billion over the next decade, and that's in part because of Medicaid spending, right?
That's right. It's basically got two reasons in the judgment of these budget analysts. One is that spending would be reduced on Medicaid, in part because the expansion of Medicaid, which is obviously the public insurance program that the federal government and states share for people who are low income, the expansion of Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act would in a few years start to be unwound. So that would reduce spending. And at the same time, the health credits in the Republicans' version of healthcare legislation would tend to be smaller for some people, not everybody, but for some people, than the ACA subsidies. So those are two main reasons why the deficit would be less than it would be under current law.
You said there was a pent-up eagerness for the results of the CBO analysis. Do you think that Republicans should have waited for those results before releasing their plan, or do you think that their strategy was a good one?
Well, I'm not obviously a political strategist, but there's been a lot of eagerness by the House Speaker, Paul Ryan, and his allies, including the committee chairs in the House of Representatives, to try to get this legislation through at least the House as quickly as they can. They're trying to do this through a bit of a political minefield because there are conservatives on the right who are really angry that this plan keeps any kind of tax credits. They think it spends too much money. On the other hand, there's criticism coming from even moderates within the Republican Party, including some Republican governors in states that have expanded Medicaid and don't want to lose the extra money that that expansion has brought their states. So Speaker Ryan and people working with him are trying to get this bill through as fast as they can, sort of navigating this minefield. So that's why they began to try to move this very quickly through House committees.
Richard Cross, you were nodding along to that response. What are you hearing about the divisions? I think divisions is not the wrong term to use within the Republican Party over this plan.
Well, I think Amy kind of sized it up very correctly. When I follow what's going on in the House, the real minefield is going to be the Senate because they don't particularly have the votes to. They have votes to repeal Obamacare. They don't have the votes to replace Obamacare. So it's almost like this is an intellectual exercise happening in the House unless something transforms the landscape in the Senate.
What sort of thing would do that?
I think I'm not sure. I don't. I think the divisions
in the House are
extreme.
What maybe come into play as we go on in this debate is the effect in the state capitals. Because while this Republican plan for getting rid of Obamacare may do good things for the federal balance sheet, it could have a very negative impact on some states, including Maryland.
What are you hearing, Michael Dresser, from the state capitol?
Well, I'm hearing a lot of trepidation from the budget leaders here, particularly Delegate Maggie McIntosh, who's looking at possible rollback of Medicaid, and she's looking at 320,000 Marylanders who got health coverage through Medicaid under Obamacare, and wondering what is going to become of them. Will the state have to pick up the costs of insuring them, or are they going to be just thrown off the insurance rolls, in which case then they show up in the emergency rooms and where their health care can be even more expensive. So it's a big unknown, and it's going to play out in every state capital in some way, and in those that expanded under Medicaid, like Maryland, even more so.
Of course, Maryland, unlike some states, does not have a full-time legislature. Is there anything that our lawmakers can do in Annapolis before sine die, which is just a couple weeks, April 10th, I think?
They're trying to make some provisions in terms of setting up commissions to monitor what changes that come down, but I mean, there's really not much they can do until they know what the federal result is.
There have been some.
If I could just jump on the question of the political cross pressures on the House leadership. I mean, Mike is absolutely right that Democratic-led states, or in case of Maryland, states with Republican governors but that have Medicaid expansions, they don't want to lose what they've gained under the ACA. On the other hand, yesterday the House Budget Committee became the third House committee in about a week and a half to put its imprimatur on this healthcare legislation. And in doing so, the House Budget Committee can't actually amend bills, but they can pass on recommendations for changes that they think a bill needs. And one of the changes that the committee recommended was to actually make the expansion of Medicaid go away even faster than it would under the House Republicans' main legislation. The bill would, as it is now, start to end the expansion of Medicaid in 2020, and all the Republicans on the House Budget Committee yesterday voted to cut off the higher level of payment that the federal government gives to these expansion states for the new people that they've enrolled starting immediately. So you can see that there are these pressures coming from absolutely opposite directions.
All the Republicans in the committee were united on that, on cutting off Medicaid, but the votes to move it out of the Budget Committee was close, wasn't it?
It was closer than it would have been if three very conservative Republicans hadn't voted against approving or sending on this legislation. And they did so because they don't like the tax credits in the bill. So that's yet another issue that the House leadership has to try to figure out how to, you know, thread this through the chamber, given all these different sentiments.
And as you said, House Speaker Paul Ryan is trying to get this through the House as quickly as possible. What are the next steps?
Well, the next step is that the bill that was, so there were two bills, one that went through the House Ways and Means Committee last week, and another that went through the Energy and Commerce Committee. Those were put together yesterday by the House Budget Committee when it approved the legislation. From here, it will go presumably early next week to what's called the House Rules Committee. We're getting a little arcane in House procedure here, but that's what happens. And they basically finalize the form of a bill that would then go on to the House floor. Now, Speaker Ryan has said that he would like this bill to come up to a vote of the floor on the floor of the Senate next week sometime. But he's also said in the last couple of days, for the very first time, you know, given all these cross pressures and people leaning on him, that he acknowledges that there may need to be some changes in the legislation before that vote, though he hasn't said what kinds of changes he'd be willing to go along with.
There have also been some rumblings that Speaker Ryan and President Trump are at odds on the bill. Ryan has said there's no palace intrigue. Let's listen to something that Ryan had to say yesterday.
Repeal and replace will be a step-by-step approach. That is why yesterday the majority leader announced that the House will begin considering additional legislation. This president is getting deeply involved. He is helping bridge gaps in our conference. He is a constructive force to help us get to a resolution so that we get consensus on how to repeal and replace Obamacare. It's been very helpful. And so we're working hand in glove, listening to the concerns of our members. As you know, now that we have our score, we can start making improvements and refinements. Clearly, the main parts of this bill are going to stay exactly as they are.
What are you hearing, Amy Goldstein, about how much involvement President Trump is having with negotiations?
Well, let me just say, not specifically with respect to the president, but the president's Health and Human Services Secretary, Tom Price, who until his confirmation, you know, just weeks ago, was a congressman from Georgia. He appeared this morning with some House Republicans and just tried as hard as he could to say that there was no difference of view between the Trump administration and the House. He said, I'm just going to give you a quote. He said, "We are excited and enthusiastic in support of this plan." So there's a big effort going on to rebuff any perception that there's a schism.
There are 237 House Republicans. The bill needs 216 of them to vote for it if no Democrats defect. I assume we're not expecting any Democrats to defect here?
There's no sign of any Democratic support so far, at least.
What do you think are the prospects that it does make it through the House this week or next?
Well, I'm always wary of predictions because you never know what's going to happen. You know, I think it's safe to say at the moment that there are more than the number of people who the House can Republicans of the House can afford to lose who are objecting to the bill for one reason or the other, either that it's spending too much or not being generous enough. But how that's going to play out in coming days as the House leadership tries to corral everybody, I think it's just too soon to predict.
And let's assume it does get through the House, then it goes to the Senate. Do you think looking at you, Richard Cross, do you think the changes that might be necessary to get it through the Senate would give it problems with the House again?
Potentially, yes. The Senate, it's a kind of crapshoot right now. There just isn't the support in the Senate to get the bill through.
And that's, so it would have to change if it's going to go through the Senate
yes.
in some way.
Mm-hmm.
What would that mean then for the House having to look at the Senate version of the bill is unclear.
There would have to be a reconciliation process.
That is Richard Cross, conservative columnist and blogger at rjc-crosspurposes on blogspot.com. Also speaking with Michael Dresser, State House correspondent for the Baltimore Sun, and Amy Goldstein, a national reporter for the Washington Post with a focus on health care. You're listening to the Midday News Wrap here on your public radio. Short break now, and when we come back, we'll invite you to share your thoughts on the week's news. You can give us a call at 410-662-8780, or you can email us at midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle is @MiddayTomHall. Back in 90 seconds. Stick around. This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Nathan Sterner in for Tom Hall. He will be back in the host chair next week. A special note about Midday next Wednesday at noon. Tom's guest for the hour will be recently retired U.S. Senator Barbara Mikulski, the longest serving woman in the history of the U.S. Congress. It's a conversation we are really looking forward to. It's Wednesday of next week. I hope you'll join us then. If you've just joined us now, this is the Midday News Wrap, our regular Friday review of some of the week's top news stories. With us today to help unpack those news stories, Amy Goldstein of the Washington Post, Michael Dresser of the Baltimore Sun, and Richard Cross, conservative columnist and blogger. I'm going to go to you, Michael Dresser, now, because we want to talk about the budget here in Maryland for the start. The House of Delegates just passed a $43.5 billion budget, moving it on to the state Senate. Of course, as you mentioned in the first part of our program, the budget can't really address any of the changes that could happen to healthcare policy, nor can it really address any of the changes that are going to be happening to the federal budgets, which we'll talk about more in a moment. What is in this budget, and why does it appear to be moving so smoothly?
Well, I think it is moving rather smoothly because you have a high degree of agreement between the Senate and the House, which is, you know, becomes more easy for them to work together when they have a Republican governor than when they have one of their own party. Having that partisan tension kind of enforces a certain amount of solidarity, you could say. And, you know, you have a fairly austere budget because revenues were in shortfall going into this this session. You know, everybody knows there's not a lot of money to play with. And so the disputes tended to be around the margins here. There really was, you know, in the context of a $43.5 billion budget, the disputes between, you know, the governor's office and the General Assembly amount to quarrels over about a couple hundred million dollars at most. It just has to do with the governor has some policy preferences where he'd like to spend some money, and the legislature has other priorities. And the legislature has a little bit more leverage this year than in past years because, you know, the governor has to ask permission not to finance some programs that he is required to finance by law. And the legislature can just say no, and, you know, in some cases it has.
Last year there was a big sticking point over education funding. What's going on that front?
Well, the amount isn't huge. It's about $5 million in this, you know, vast budget, but it's more of a philosophical point. The governor, would like to provide some aid to private schools, especially for scholarships for families to send their kids to private schools. The Senate is sympathetic to that point of view. But the House is very jealous of any diversion of funds from public education to private schools. And they're not enthused about this program called Boost that that does provide some aid to for scholarships to private schools. And the House proposed a big cut to that program. Now, the governor has protested that vehemently. But when it goes into conference with the Senate, it's very likely that the House cut will have to in some way be compromised, to come out of conference.
You expect that the Senate's going to restore the cut in its version of the budget?
I would not be surprised if it did, if not in whole, in part. And then the Senate, of course, would have to come up with some counter proposal, but those are the kind of things that have gone into conference before and been resolved, and I would expect that they will be resolved this year.
Any other particular sticking points you see in budget negotiations in Annapolis?
Nothing big, nothing really huge. The Senate is just completing its committee work on the budget, and we'll have its budget on the floor next week. So we'll see what other differences emerge. But, the kind of back-channel communication between the chairman of the budget committees in the House and the Senate has been strong, and I think they're likely to have resolved most of their differences in advance.
Early this year?
They've been in consultation throughout the session.
Let's move on then to the national budget. The preliminary budget from the Trump administration came out yesterday. We will be getting more details on this budget later. This is just a budget blueprint, as they have often said. And this only covers discretionary spending, which is just a little more than a quarter of the actual federal budget. The rest, the mandatory spending, goes to things like Medicare and to Social Security. Amy Goldstein, what have we learned about President Trump's budget priorities from the budget blueprint that came out yesterday?
Well, as you say, this is really a broad strokes budget, and it's the first time that we've seen the president's big picture priorities translated into his fiscal aspirations. And what it shows is that he would like to substantially increase federal spending on defense and really decrease spending on other areas. The State Department would get a very large decrease. Environmental programs, the Environmental Protection Agency, would get a big decrease. Department of Health and Human Services, which I pay a lot of attention to, would get a substantial decrease. I mean, it would be, as you say, on the discretionary side of the spending, leaving out the cost of covering people on Medicare and Medicaid, it would get a $69 billion amount of spending, and that would be a nearly 18% cut from the most recent budget. So that's a big decrease.
Since you follow DHS matters so closely, what do we know about how this cut would affect that department?
Well, it looks as if one really big chunk of the cut would come over at the National Institutes of Health. The overall cut to HHS would be about $15 billion, and more than a third of that would be for NIH. It's discretionary budget. It's research. It's basically the kind of nation's engine of biomedical research, both doing research in-house in NIH, but more to the point, providing funding for researchers doing biomedical research all around the country. And there would be a 19% decrease in NIH's discretionary budget. So that's pretty big. The budget also talks just in very unspecific terms about a major reorganization of the NIH institutes and centers. It doesn't explain what that would consist of, but it does say that the administration would like to somehow reorganize NIH.
And the NIH being here in Maryland's headquartered, that could affect the state.
Absolutely.
That's right, it's in Bethesda.
Yes, and you know, if you have a decrease in employment there, it plays out in terms of income tax, sales tax, and it reverbs here in Annapolis for the next budget cycle.
Defense spending up 9% under this blueprint, some $54 billion. What would that do?
Well, I'm not a defense expert, but the president has made clear that he wants to increase, you know, the military role and capacity of this country. There would also be funding, of course, to carry out the president's off-stated goal of building a wall at the southwestern border of this country with Mexico. So there's funding for that, too.
And that would just be the start. $2.6 billion for the border wall, but estimates say that the wall would cost significantly more, right?
That's right. It would be the part of the funding that would go in this next year's budget.
The budget also puts a significant amount of money into school voucher programs, some $1.4 billion. The Education Department actually ends up seeing a cut because of cuts in grants to teacher training and federal work study stuff. But still, $1.4 billion is being added for school voucher programs. Do you expect that will be going anywhere?
Well, it's hard to know where it's going to go politically, but that shift is very consistent with the longstanding focus of Secretary Voss, who came into this role at the Education Department without much history of overseeing public education, but a big champion of efforts to improve funding for other kinds of education, whether they're charter schools or private schools or parochial schools. So this budget really reflects what the new secretary has been saying for a long time before she came to Washington.
I wanted to kind of add something about the kind of implications for Governor Hogan from a governance standpoint. Governor Hogan famously refused to support President Trump. This budget includes cuts to Chesapeake Bay programs, includes cuts to legal aid. So right now, the governor, despite the fact that he kind of exercised a bit of apostasy during the last campaign with respect to Trump, now he has to basically deal with the actions of his fellow Republican in the White House. So this is a kind of hazardous territory for Governor Hogan.
Since you brought up Governor Hogan, how do you see him navigating this? I mean, he's popular, very popular here in Maryland. He's a Republican, Maryland, a Democrat-dominated state. And President Trump is very not popular here in Maryland. How does he move forward with an eye to the next year's election, trying to keep himself apart?
I think the kind of strategy of just not commenting about what is happening in Washington, it's not going to work for him anymore. He needs to kind of be very public about advocating for example, the Chesapeake Bay programs and things of that nature. He needs to be heard. And I don't think that avoiding controversy is going to work for him anymore.
And that has seemed to be his strategy, to generally not comment on issues involving the president.
I think the shelf life in that strategy has ended.
So do you think he's going to have to become a vocal opponent of Trump in order to maintain the popularity he currently enjoys?
Yes, but I think he has to pick his battles very carefully. I don't think he can just indiscriminately attack the president of his own party, but he needs to kind of identify some areas in which he very decidedly differentiates himself from the president.
Is there any possibility doing so might create problems within his Republican base within the state?
Yes, definitely. But right now, I think he's popular enough among Republicans where it's not going to be lasting damage. I think there's maybe a nugget of the Republican base in Maryland that is upset that he didn't support Trump. But I think overall, politically, through the campaign, that was a good strategy. But now, from a governance standpoint, there are additional concerns that he's facing.
And Richard Goss, you mentioned the Chesapeake Bay funding for restoration, that a cut, part of massive cuts to the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. I want to go to a clip from Mick Mulvaney, the OMB director, speaking about climate change and about funding to the EPA.
As to climate change, I think the president was fairly straightforward, is that we're not spending money on that anymore. We consider that to be a waste of your money to go out and do that. So that is a specific tie to his campaign.
EPA cuts 31% under the Trump budget, a loss of $73 million in funding for a Chesapeake Bay cleanup, cuts to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration on programs designed to prepare communities for rising sea levels. And that's not just climate stuff. Here in Maryland, we have a settling continent, so sea levels are rising even if there were no climate-related factors anyway. What does that mean for Maryland specifically, especially the loss of Chesapeake Bay funding? Michael Dresser.
Well, it puts a great deal more pressure on state government. It either just kind of, you know, watches as the bay kind of goes backward, or it has to backfill with funds of its own. And you know, with Maryland's budget, there just isn't room for a whole lot of backfilling without more revenues, and this governor is not about raising more revenues, so it's a real squeeze.
Actually, we're at the moment about raising less revenues because Maryland downgraded revenue projections. Was it early this week or late last week?
That's in terms of what you're getting back. I mean, more in terms of do you raise taxes,
right,
or fees or some other way, and that does not seem to be an option now. Maryland's, you know, revenue picture is kind of hard to foresee right now. But the changes they're talking about in Washington, you know, could pose real problems when you get around to September and December revenue estimates.
Yeah, and assuming, as you said, there aren't any changes to revenue and the structural, the taxes or fees. The downgrade of revenue projections was before this blueprint budget came out, before the cuts in funding to the Chesapeake Bay and other areas.
That's correct.
So are you expecting that when we get the next round of projections, it may be even farther down?
It could be very troublesome, depending on what, you know, Congress does with the Trump administration's proposals. I mean, when you're talking about things like, you know, cutbacks to the federal workforce and NIH, and
we are very dependent on the federal
other
workforce.
Agencies, and when you talk about these agencies, you're not just talking about their direct employees. You're talking about contractors who are a big part of the Maryland economy, and it's not just the cuts themselves. I mean, if you're a federal worker in a vulnerable job in Montgomery or Prince George's County right now, are you going to feel like spending a whole lot? I suspect that you'll be, you know, waiting and watching rather than making big purchases.
And back to the Chesapeake Bay, will the planned cleanup, the planned restoration process move forward even without the federal funding?
That's uncertain. You just don't know how much of it can continue without the federal role.
And even if we here in Maryland continue, it's of course there are six other states in the Bay watershed. If they choose not to, we will reap the negatives of that.
It's correct. Only two of the states in the Bay watershed feel a deep connection to the Bay. Except for, you know, Maryland and Virginia, which, you know, live and breathe the Bay, the other states involved have pretty much have to be nudged to make any contribution to it.
Right. Folks in Pennsylvania, New York, and West Virginia don't see the Bay on a regular basis.
Correct.
Any other thoughts on the Trump budget before we go to break?
Well, just that it's going to be interesting when later in the year, I think in May, the administration comes out with the details of what lies behind this kind of top line, because there are many things that are just not mentioned. For instance, this budget doesn't say how much it would continue to fund food stamps or nation's main welfare program. I mean, it's clear that it's got some designs on decreasing funding for anti-poverty programs, such as something called community services block grants, but there are just lots of things that aren't yet visible.
So the details come out in May. When does it need to be passed, or when does something need to be passed?
Well, Congress has not been lately been keeping to its schedule. I mean, the new fiscal year starts in on October 1st, but whether there'll be a budget fully in place by then, it's hard to say.
That's Amy Goldstein, national reporter for The Washington Post, who focuses on health care policy. Also this hour, we're hearing from Michael Dresser, State House correspondent for The Baltimore Sun, and Richard Cross, conservative columnist and blogger at rjc-crosspurposes on blogspot.com. Another short break now. When we come back, you are welcome to join in the conversation. Give us a call at 410-662-8780. Email us at midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle is @MiddayTomHall. And Tom Hall's out today. I'm Nathan Sterner. Stay with us. This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. And you are listening to the Midday News Wrap. With us today to help unpack some of the news of the week is, here in studio, Richard Cross, conservative columnist and blogger. Amy Goldstein, national reporter for The Washington Post, who focuses on healthcare policy, is on the line from the Post's newsroom in Washington, D.C. And on the line from Annapolis is Michael Dresser, State House correspondent for The Baltimore Sun. Back to you, Michael, because there's a lot of stuff going on in the General Assembly that is not directly about the budget. One of the big issues is paid sick leave. The House of Delegates has passed a bill requiring that companies with 15 employees or more provide up to 7 days of paid sick leave to their workers a year, 5 days for a version that housed the state Senate yesterday. Both of these bills passed by a veto-proof margin, and Governor Hogan has said that he would veto either of these bills or whatever compromise comes out of them if it reaches his desk. What is going on here?
Well, the bills will have to go to conference, and in the conference committee, it's always the less ambitious bill that has the upper hand. So the chances of a bill coming out of conference with the 7 days are very slim. However, the Senate has a very narrow veto-proof margin. All they have to do is lose one senator on an override vote, and the governor's veto can be sustained. So if you voted for the Senate bill based on its being only 5 days, going to seven could lose your vote. So the Senate's position is much stronger going into conference on that.
Governor Hogan has his own sick leave bill, which would affect fewer companies, companies with 50 or more employees. Is that going to go anywhere? I think it's still stuck in committee, right?
It's not going anywhere.
It's not going anywhere?
The houses have made their decisions. They've gone with their own bills on that. And, if the governor's bill gets a vote at all, it will be voted down.
So I think it's safe to assume that whatever comes out on the paid sick leave front, it's going to be vetoed.
I would assume so.
What happens then?
Well, depending on when in the session there is final passage, they would either take an override vote before the end of this session or do it next January.
How much time do they have to do it at the end of the session?
It's about a couple weeks. If they can wrap it up very fast, I think they can do an override vote before the end of the session, but there's a pretty narrow window there. It's iffy whether it could happen by the end of the session.
So there would be an override vote. Any chance that you see of a special session for an override vote should it not be approved in time to be done this session, or would it definitely wait until next year?
I think it would wait till next year. I think the special session it's a heavy lift to call a special session under any circumstances. hauling people back here to Annapolis is it's a costly measure, and it's hard on a part-time legislature.
And I would point out, when Governor Ehrlich was in office, special sessions didn't work out all that well for him. So bringing the legislature back in a special session is probably something Governor Hogan would not do.
Another thing about Governor Hogan is he really, really likes it when the legislature is not in Annapolis.
And I feel like the legislature often seems grumpy about returning whenever there's a special session. So I think the feeling may be mutual.
That's correct. I mean, it's special sessions, you know, they're just, legislators have lives too. They make vacation plans. And then if somebody calls a special session and they've put down a deposit on a condo somewhere, well, you know, they're out of luck.
Another thing that you've been following, Michael, the issue of bail reform, and there has been a lot of movement on that this week. Tell us what's
absolutely.
Going on.
Absolutely. In fact, I came down to come on this show right from a debate on bail reform. Senate has brought out a bill, had it on the floor, that is very much at odds with the Attorney General, and, it's at odds with the Black Caucus here, and it's going to be a bumpy ride here on that issue, and that could be take us up right up to adjournment.
And the bail reform issue comes up in part because the state's highest court changed the rules earlier this year on bail, saying that judges and commissioners should not impose bails that defendants are not able to pay. What exactly are these measures doing? I know the the Legislative Black Caucus has said not to move on any of the bills this session.
That's right. They want to see the rule go into effect and, you know, be tested for a while before the legislature acts. But the Senate committee, is under the impression that the rule is already having some bad effects, and there's also a feeling that that the legislature, not the judiciary, should be the policymaker. And they've brought a bill to the floor that kind of restores bail's role in the options for pretrial release. I mean, the court had not ruled out bail, but they'd certainly de-emphasized it. And the Senate bill is basically saying that bail shall be considered in the same, you know, level as other forms of pretrial release. It just remains to be seen what's going to happen when they send that bill over to the House side.
The bail bonds industry, a big and very visible one, at least here in Baltimore City, what role is it playing in this legislation?
They're playing a huge role. I mean, they are, you see their representatives here outside every voting session. They're present at every hearing. They've mobilized support from around the country for their position, they are huge campaign contributors.
Let's take a quick call from Mike in Severn. Mike, welcome to the Midday News Wrap.
Hi, thank you. One of the things that struck me when I heard the federal budget comments from the OMB director was that this was intended to keep us safe, and that the focus needs to be on the military and Homeland Security, and consequently we need to cut a third of the budget out of the EPA. And I'm stunned that people don't look at the Environmental Protection Agency's role in keeping them safe from environmental threats and the types of things that we were dealing with when you think back to the 60s and the 70s when we had, you know, very bad air, very bad water. The EPA's, it's almost like we've taken it for granted, the types of, the amount of progress that we've made. And I'd like to hear what you guys think about, you know, trying to turn that around politically and making safe mean something other than, you know, military.
Thanks so much for your call, Mike. Any thoughts on that?
Well, if you remember, Richard Nixon is the president who signed the EPA into law. And for a very long time in American history, it's been kind of a consensus for support for environmental programs.
Didn't George H.W. Bush call himself the number one environmental president at one point?
He signed clean water legislation.
Yeah.
And so, clean air legislation.
So why has this become such a partisan issue?
I think it's just general distrust of Washington and bureaucracies, and it's just become part of the mix that we're seeing in Washington these days.
I think there's also an element of organized spending on political causes by some people who are very much anti-regulation of any kind.
Yep. Amy Goldstein?
Yeah, I think what we're seeing here is a real shift in values within the Republican Party over the last couple of decades. And, as now President Trump was running and as he was choosing people to put into his cabinet, it was clear that these, strong defense inclinations and anti-environmental inclinations were going to be a big part of this administration's identity. So this budget is basically putting dollars and cents to, or attempting to put dollars and cents to, the values of this administration.
One more quick thing before we wrap up the Midday News Wrap for this week. The travel ban, the second travel ban, the executive order by President Trump, overruled by two federal judges this week. The Maryland judge overruled a part of the ban. A judge in Hawaii blocked the entirety of it. What is next here?
Well, I think I had seen where some of President Trump's supporters in Congress are urging him to ignore what the judges have done. So we're going to have to see what the president does next.
Can the president do that? Ignore the judges' blocking of the ban?
I think they'll try.
Well, what we saw very quickly was the president's press secretary, Sean Spicer, saying that the administration plans to appeal these two rulings. And if you think about it, this is the second time that the administration has put out an attempted travel ban and visa restrictions, and just on the cusp of it taking effect, federal judge or a couple of federal judges have said not so fast. So it's just kind of cycling back through back and forth between the administration and the courts, and it's not going so well so far from the administration, but the legal fight's not over yet.
And I know I heard the president saying that he would suggest returning to the original travel ban, the one that was first put on hold. What would that mean?
It's hard to see that how he would do that without, ignoring judicial orders, which leads to a constitutional crisis. And it would be quite a move on his part if he did.
Well, it's been quite a busy week, and it likely will be quite a busy week in the coming week. That's all the time we have for this week's News Wrap. Amy Goldstein is a national reporter for The Washington Post. Michael Dresser, State House correspondent for The Baltimore Sun. Richard Cross, conservative columnist and blogger at rjc-crosspurposes on blogspot.com. Thanks so much for all of you for coming in and for joining us on the line.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And glad to talk with you.
Be sure to catch Midday next week here on WIPR. Tom Hall will be back on the host chair Monday with a new edition of our regular health feature, Smart Nutrition, with licensed nutritionist Monica Reinigel. Then Tom will talk with Eric Conway, director of the Morgan State University Choir, about the school's upcoming production of The Wiz. That's on Monday. Midday Tuesday, Tom hosts a special hour with longtime WIPR contributor and teller of Baltimore stories, Gil Sandler. He'll be joined by veteran Baltimore Sun editor Fred Rasmussen and WIPR's own Ken Jackson, host of In the Mood, to talk about Gil's new radio documentary, Baltimore in the Great Depression, a richly produced account of a memorable era in the city's history. And that documentary is going to air next Tuesday, right here on WIPR. And once again, a special note about next Wednesday's show. Tom's guest will be recently retired Maryland Senator Barbara Mikulski. You won't want to miss it. Lunch for our guest today provided by Two Boots Pizza on West Mount Royal Avenue near Micah, UB, and Central Baltimore. Two Boots offers creative and traditional New York pizzas with a New Orleans twist for on-site dining, catering, and delivery. You can reach them online at twoboots.com. Midday's director and engineer is Luke Spicknall. The show is produced by Rob Sivek, Bridget Armstrong, and Kathleen Cahill. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. Charlie Hines provides production assistance. I'm Nathan Sterner. Thanks for listening. Tom Hall will be back with you on Monday. Have a great weekend.